So let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual and our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NAVA Zoom room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And I sent a chat to Amanda asking her to introduce our speaker tonight. So are you there, Amanda?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you so much. What an honor. My name's Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. And I know I'm sitting here waiting for you guys to reply. I'm sorry. It is my complete honor to introduce tonight's speaker. Like she said earlier, I literally met her in prison. And I like to tell that story to people because they always think we were there together, but she was actually carrying the message to me. And if she hadn't been so dedicated to fill out all that paperwork and go through all the bureaucratic rigmarole to get into the prison, I wouldn't be sitting here today sober. And she's been with me through thin and thin. She has a rock solid program of recovery that she shares so willingly with so many women. And she's amazing, and her story is amazing, and I am honored to introduce my sponsor, Heather.
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you so much. Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Heather, and I'm really glad to be here with you guys tonight. Okay, so I'm going to do a shameless plug before I forget and get to the top of the hour. So Amanda is speaking in 2 weeks, and she has got an amazing story of reconciliation is the best way to put it all through. So please come back in 2 weeks and make sure that you catch her story because it's pretty incredible. All right, so I usually like to start out with some housekeeping stuff because I'm nervous, and being on Zoom doesn't seem to make that any less. I can say this, that I'm really glad I'm not having to stand at a podium and, you know, feeling my knees shaking right now because I've done that in the past. So the housekeeping stuff, my sobriety date is January 10th of 2005. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has 34 years of sobriety. I have sponsees. I have 3 sponsees. Actually, kind of 2.5. One of them hasn't checked in with me in a few weeks, so I'm not even sure if I'm still working with her or not. I have a home group. My home group is the Quarantined and Sober Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's through Zoom, and it's my favorite way to start out the day at 7:30 in the morning. I do service. I don't do intense service right now, and I'll probably explain why a little bit later. I have been I'm a true alcoholic. I can use anything to not have to feel the feelings that are coming up. And I have done that with service in the past. I have, overwhelmed and overloaded myself with service so that I didn't have to address the feelings that were coming up with me and the problems that I was having. And so I'm being very mindful these days about where I do service and why I'm doing it. So at this point, I don't have a service commitment, but I've had plenty of them, and I'm not shying away from them in the future. I also want to mention that, you know, I picked up 16 years at the beginning of January, and I wish I could sit here and tell you that everything was roses and sunshine since then. That has not been the case. I am a member of 2 other 12-step programs. one of which I just started going to. I'm not going to get into that, but what I have found is that they are both directly related to my alcoholism. And I mean directly related to my alcoholism. They didn't cause my alcoholism, but they were very much hand in hand. I'm an alcoholic because I enjoy the way the effects that alcohol had on me. And I have to tell you from the outset, I loved the taste of alcohol. I think there's one type of liquor that I did not enjoy the taste of. And everything else, I enjoyed it all the different ways. But especially, I enjoyed the effect that alcohol had on me. So I grew up in Louisiana, and my father was an alcoholic who was not allowed to drink in the house, so he snuck a lot of drinking. You know, I remember at about 10 or 11 years old getting pulled over by the sheriff who lived behind us. I grew up in a very small town with like 1,300 people in, you know, population. And the sheriff who lived behind us actually pulled us over one night on the way home and gave him a field sobriety test, you know, by the side of the road. And I didn't know what was happening. I was watching out the back of the truck, but I didn't know what was happening. He didn't arrest him. He basically just told him that he would follow him to the house to make sure we got there safely. My mother, okay, so I should say my parents are phenomenal. They are the reason why I love doing service. They showed me how to be of service. They were very good at practicing their religion. They were very kind. I never wanted for anything. I was given anything I wanted. But we also, you know, not everybody's perfect. So we also had these little hang-ups, too. And my mother, I was never beaten, but the words that were used sometimes were pretty harsh. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a very thinking that, A, this was a moral issue, that my alcoholism was a moral issue, and, B, that there was something, you know, that I was wrong. Not that there was something wrong with me, but that I was wrong. And so it's been a process of trying to come back out of that way of thinking, because it didn't go away my first time through the steps, my second time through the steps, my third or my fourth time through the steps. So, but I never felt like I belonged. I mean, and I think that's the biggest thing from my childhood, is that I swore up and down for 3 years that I was adopted, because I never felt like I belonged in my family at all. And at the age of 14, I discovered the joy of alcohol. A friend of mine and I split a six-pack of beer. And her father owned a roller skating rink, and we went over to that roller skating rink on that Friday night. And, man, I could talk to boys, and I could dance, and I was funny, and I was comfortable in my own skin for the first time in my life. Like, I felt like I belonged. And that was at 14. By the time I was 16, I had my driver's license, and I was driving home in blackouts at that point. And when I asked my friends about it, they said, well, if you're going to drink the way you drink, this is what's going to happen. And so I was like, well, not drinking the way I drink is not an option. So I'm just going to have to deal with it. I got married at 17 because they changed the drinking age in Louisiana. That's a really good way to get married. And you have to imagine that the guy who would marry a 17-year-old who was 21 and the person I would pick was probably not the best choice on the planet. Even on, you know, not even the best choice in town. But I did get married at 17, and I remember hearing the radio station when they said, you know, that they were changing the drinking age of Louisiana, and I was not going to get grandfathered in to drinking, which means I was going to have to wait another 3 years before I could drink legally. So I took matters into my own hands and wooed, and I do not use that term lightly, I wooed this guy who had proven himself to be violent with me in the past. And I did that because I couldn't imagine having to wait another 3 years before I could drink legally. So at 18, I had my first 30-day binge. where we went out and got drunk every night, and I had D2s at the end of that. And while I was laying on the couch, I didn't realize, I don't think he or I, my husband or I at the time, realized that you can actually die from DTs. But I was laying there on the couch, hallucinating, sweating, you know, the whole nine yards, and the, you know, the rocking and the rolling. And I said, you know, I don't understand what's going on with me. And he explained, you know, you're detoxing right now. And if you're going to drink the way you drink, this is what's going to happen. And, you know, it never, like, the concept of not drinking the way I wanted to drink was never an option for me. Like, I never even thought about, like, what would life be without alcohol. So years later, I'm not going to go into, I like to remember that part of it because I drank for 20 years. And, or actually 21 now that I think about, I drank for 21 years and it never got any better than that. There were periods of time where I would control it and I wouldn't drink as much, but never, did it get better in the long run. Always there was some point at which I would turn around and I would justify taking that first drink. I would justify getting drunk and I would justify like just like losing my mind entirely. So, we had two kids, and things were not getting better with us, between us either. He was getting much more violent. He was physically, emotionally, sexually, and verbally abusive. And, you know, I can sit here and tell you guys that today, knowing what part of that is mine and what part of that is his, because I've done, you know, in my first four step, like all of that anger that I had towards him, all of the vitriol, the acid that I had towards him, it all went away during that first, fourth, and fifth step because I could see my part in it finally. I spent a long time not understanding what my part in that was and drinking over it, justifying getting drunk over it. I left when he, so, you know, I was trying anything to get out of myself, and one of the things that I did at the end of our, towards the end of our marriage for the last 6 months, I was drinking, you know, a 12-pack of beer every night so that I would not leave. I was 21 by this point, so the minute I turned 21, like, I really didn't need to be married anymore. So I was drinking a 12-pack of beer every night, and I was cheating on him. And I was documenting everything that I was doing in a journal. I have a tendency these days to not want to journal anymore because I've had three or four partners who have found my journals and gotten angry about what they wrote. So I don't necessarily write everything down anymore unless it's a fourth step and I'm sharing it with my sponsor. But basically he found the journal and he pulled a gun on me. And he wanted to pull the trigger. I know that. I know that to this day. He wanted to pull the trigger so bad. But my higher power, who has been with me the entirety of my life, whether I was connected to him or whether I was not connected to him, my higher power has been protecting me my whole life. The thing that came out of my mouth when he did this was, if you pull that trigger, the kids at the other end of this house are going to be orphans, because I'll be dead and you'll be in jail. And, you know, do you want that for them? And I passed out. I think the horror of it, the trauma of it, just I passed back out. And so I ended up leaving the next day. And, you know, then it was just like on and popping. I mean, I left the kids with him over the course of the next 15, 16 years, you know, they would come live with me when the violence with their dad was so bad that they couldn't handle it anymore. And then they would come live with me. And then when my alcoholism was so bad that they couldn't handle that anymore, they would go back to live with their dad. You know, I did geographic cures. I was in and out of relationships. I tried all different methods to control my drinking. Nothing was working. The last 4 years of my drinking were absolutely horrible. I had been engaged at one point to this man who was very healthy, and I had quit drinking for 6 weeks because he wanted us to quit drinking together, which was kind of funny because he didn't drink. So it was kind of, you know, it was kind of like get Heather to stop drinking. And he and I quit drinking, and I went crazy. I mean, it's not just like, you know, I went crazy in my mind. I put a hole in the wall of the house we were living in. I hurdled the couch and went running up to him with my fist cocked back. I was going to hit him. I mean, I was losing my ever-loving mind, and I couldn't understand why. I didn't know that it had anything to do with the fact that I needed to drink. I either needed a spiritual solution, or I needed an Alcoholics Anonymous, or I needed a drink, one or the other. And so I ended up kicking him out. I ended up breaking up with him. And I could not get him out of the house fast enough. This should have been a sign, right? I went to go open the door to go to the grocery store as soon as he left. I mean, I had my keys and my wallet in my going to the store so that I could buy a case of beer. And my hand hit that doorknob, and the thought just, I mean, it came up from within me. It's not my own thought. This is a thought from my higher power that said, you could pray. And I was like, no. Prayer's going to take too long. Prayer's going to take, like, you know, weeks. It's going to take prayer weeks to get this off my back, to get rid of this craving. And so I went to the store, and I got that case of beer, and that started the last 3.5, 4 years of my drinking. And at that point, because I did not get what I wanted, I had a working relationship with my higher power up until that point, but I wanted to be married. I wanted to have a relationship. That is something I have wanted my entire life. And when that relationship fell apart, I checked out of that relationship with my higher power. I didn't understand. I mean, I had no concept whatsoever of my part in any of that. I had no concept whatsoever in the fact that, you know, I'm not getting what I want because maybe there's a better, you know, there's a better reason why. But basically, I mean, I just because that relationship ended, I just said, you know, peace out to my higher power. And I still, like, I was still conscious of that connection, but I wanted nothing to do with it at all. And anytime thoughts would come up in my head, because that whole thought, you could pray, did not go away. It kept coming up for me. When I was driving to work and I was, you know, drunk still from the night before, I would turn up the radio really loud so that I didn't have to hear the voice inside my own mind, you know. I tried to run so far from my higher power. The last couple of months of my drinking were, you know, both of my kids had left. They could not live with me anymore. I was driving drunk with them in the car. I was not coming home from work. I was stopping off at the bar to have a couple of drinks, and then I would never make it home. I was calling pizzas in, you know, and having them delivered to my house. And, I wouldn't even see my kids for days. You know, I'd go home, but they would already be in bed, and then they would get up and get themselves ready for school while I was, you know, still asleep, passed out. So, I like to remember this story because I was getting to the point, you know, that time that my dad got pulled over and he was given, you know, the roadside sobriety test. When we got home, I went to my mother and I wanted to tell her, like, there's always been a part of me that has loved honesty and that wants to be honest. And so, you know, I went to my mom and I tried to tell her what was happening, and she didn't want any part of it. You know, like, she didn't want to know about what was happening with my dad's drinking. And I had been running from the truth for so long. I was out with some friends one night. We were out watching, it doesn't even matter. We were out drinking in a park. And I was driving a friend of mine home, and I sideswiped a vehicle sitting on the side of the road. and took off my, you know, I could have killed him basically if I'd hit the truck head on. It knocked my rear view mirror off. It knocked the rear view mirror off of the truck. And I was just like, I'm so, you know, because he was like, go, go, go. And he had some dry goods on him and he didn't want anything to happen. I was exhausted though. I was just tired and I pulled down the street and I pulled over on the side of the road and he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going back. I mean, they're out there looking at my license plate number. They're going to call the police. So I'm just going to go back and I'm going to wait for the police because something needs to happen. And, something has got to get between me and the next drink. And, he took off running because, you know, he didn't want anything to do with the police. And I was just like, whatever, I don't care. I went back to this party and it turned out that it was an underage frat party where they had dry goods of their own in the house. They had a keg in the house and they weren't calling. I mean, I offered to call the police and they said, no, we're going to call the police, but you should probably just go home. And I was like, no, I want to wait here. I need, you know, they were like, you're going to get arrested. And I was like, that's fine. I'll get arrested. I'm done. I'm so over this. Well, of course, they never called the police. And one of the very fine young men who was there, who I knew through a mutual friends, drove me home that night. And I couldn't even get arrested. So, you know, at that point, I just started calling in drunk to work. I stopped calling in sick because I was tired of lying to them. I was so tired of all the lies. I was so exhausted. And finally, I hit the end of my rope, and the only thing that I knew to do was to check out. I had been praying for death for a while, but it wasn't happening, right? Like, it just wasn't happening. So I took a whole bunch of, my doctor had given me Xanax because, you know, when I would go in and I'd be shaking like this, she would say, well, it looks like anxiety, so I'm going to give you some Xanax. So I had this entire bottle of Xanax and, I took that entire bottle, wrote this, just rambling note and went to bed. And I had no plans whatsoever of waking up the next morning, but apparently I had made some phone calls. And I had friends who for 2 hours tried to wake me up from the outside. And they finally called the police. And when the police were beating on the door, something roused me. And they came in and, you know, of course, and I always like to remember this part too because it keeps me humble. So they told my friend Allison, they told her, you know, we've called the EMTs. You're going to have to get her dressed because I was in a, I have no idea what I was thinking, but I had dressed in a negligee to go to heaven. You know, I have no idea. I was going to show God, you know, look at what you, it makes no sense to me now. But they basically told her, you're going to have to go get her dressed. So she put me in a pink silk square dance skirt, a hot pink square dance skirt, a Cramps t-shirt. Cramps is a punk band. And SpongeBob SquarePants socks, and sent me to the emergency room looking like the mess that I was on the inside. And I like to remember that because very humble beginnings, you know. So in the emergency room, the doctor, I remember asking me, do you drink because you're depressed? Or are you depressed because you drink? And I said, I don't know, and I don't care. And he said, well, why did you try to kill yourself? And I started giving this litany of all this stuff from my ex-husband. He's married now. He's got the kids living with him. He's got a farm with horses, you know. And this is how he treated me. And, you know, poor me, pity, pity, pity. And the doctor said, oh, well, how long ago did you leave him? You know, and I said, oh, it was 92. And he said, it's 2005. And I didn't, like, there was a disconnect. I was like, okay, so? And he said, that's 13 years. 13 years, you're still hanging on to this. And they put me in a locked facility there. And they kept me there for 10 days, which is the maximum amount of time, because I wouldn't take antabuse. And I was not happy to be there. I was not happy about still being alive for the first day. But I remember the moment of clarity on the second day that I was there when I got a little sliver of hope because I went to an AA meeting and I heard one of the speakers share, and they shared about how they hadn't had a drink in a while. And I had no hope that I would be happy. I had no hope that I would be, you know, able to love. I had no hope that I would be able to have friendships or relationships or go out dancing or go see a movie or go see a, you know, a concert. I had no hope about any of this stuff when I got here. I just didn't want to take the next drink because I didn't want to try to kill myself again. And I started going to meetings. I mean, I was adamant about going to meet. I would go to 2 and 3 a day if I had to. You know, I went to meetings all the time, and I found a sponsor. And it's kind of funny, my sponsor, I knew she was the one I wanted because she got up to the podium to tell her story one night, and she introduced herself with 7 last names. And she said, 4 of those marriages were in sobriety. 4 of those marriages and divorces were in sobriety. And I was like, this is who I want. I want her. Because I knew that for me, going through a breakup was going to be my Achilles heel. That was going to be the thing that would threaten my sobriety the most. And I needed to know how to do that. I needed to know how to go through a breakup and stay sober and not pick up a drink. And she got me right into the steps. The only step that I kind of dragged my feet on was the 4th step, and it's because I kept getting emotional about it until she said, go back and look at how it's done in the big book. And what I noticed is in the big book, Bill uses only 4 or 5, maybe 7 words to describe the cause. And so I went back and I said, okay, I can use 5 to 7 words to describe the cause, which is that second column. And it forced me to take the emotional sting out of doing that 4th step, and I was able to get it done in 2 weeks. I scheduled a time with her, and I got it done in 2 weeks. And I took it very seriously. I had political parties on my list. I had politicians from all levels of government. I had journalists. And I had all the personal people. I went all the way back to childhood, you know, to kindergarten. I mean, I dredged up everything I possibly could because I was terrified of taking a drink. And I remember after I did my 5th step, she burned my 4th step. We went out into her backyard, and she had a fire pit, and she set it on fire. And it was beautiful because the moon was full, and there was a halo around it. And I remember just thinking, because I think she knew that if I held on to this, I was going to look back at it, and I was going to get emotionally charged again and again and again. And that's been one of the best things that has ever happened, is to have my 4th step gone, you know, to have done it and then let it go. I've had sponsors throughout my entire sobriety, and I have continued to work the steps with various sponsors, focusing on certain things. It did turn out recently that I had to look at another program because trying to do the steps the way we did them in Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't working for some of those issues. And, you know, I think I noticed a lot of things and I watch a lot of things. There was a guy who got up and told his story at the area assembly in South Carolina one time. And he had 20 years, and he said, you know, for the first 20 years, and he had over 20 years, sorry, he had like 30 years. He said, for the first 20 years of my sobriety, I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I would tell newcomers, and I would tell anybody else, that there was no reason that they needed any medication. No antidepressants, no anti-anxiety meds, none of this. You know, if you're needing medication, you're not practicing the AA program. He said, and then at 20 years, I was hospitalized for depression, for major depression. And he said, you know, I have had to eat my words. And there are certain things that I have, in my sobriety, where I have been very adamant, you know, you're not sober if you're doing this, not sober, if you're doing that. And invariably what happens, every time I judge someone else's sobriety that way, there's a couple of things that happen. One is that the voice comes back and it cuts me. I don't know whether that's karma or what it is, but it invariably comes back and cuts me down as well. And it basically leaves this whole area of people who I don't feel connected to in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's almost like I'm judging. Like, you belong here if you're like this, and you don't belong here if you're like that. But there's nothing in the traditions that says that. There's nothing that I have ever been taught that has said that. These are just concepts that have come up for me. And one of these ways that I have had to admit powerlessness recently has really made me question as to whether or not I feel like I have a choice some way in not taking a drink today. And I'm just saying that to be honest with all of you. I think that it's very tricky. I think that in the first few years, probably the first 5 years, I was very conscious of the fact that I didn't have a choice in whether or not I was going to pick up a drink. It was my higher power who was controlling that. But the longer I stay sober here, and the more that I go through difficult situations and don't pick up a drink, it gets really hard to realize that my higher power is the one that's controlling that. It's not me making that choice. It is my higher power removing the craving. My connection with my higher power continuing to remove the craving. It has nothing to do with whether or not Heather chose to pick up the first drink. But it's been very humbling to realize that I've had these thoughts, I've had these ideas, these beliefs deep down inside me about being sober. In 2016, my dad passed away, and I love what Tim said at the beginning about how we came to know our higher power. I mean, the whole process of doing the steps the first time, I was became very aware of my connection with my higher power. I started praying on my knees. I had no problem with that. I had many different circumstances that arose that showed me when I don't pray in the morning, this is the screwed up kind of day I'm going to have. And when I do pray in the morning, this is how I will know everything that needs to be done sequentially, without me even having to try. The answers will just come. And they did. And then I got introduced to a new concept of a higher power. And the only thing that I can say, so somebody from, a lady from the morning meeting that is my home group, when I was telling her about this thing that happened, she said, what you're describing sounds like a conversion experience. I went into a meditation center. I have never, ever, I've studied a lot of different religions in my lifetime. And I went into this meditation center in Columbia, South Carolina, where I got sober. And immediately when I went into the meditation room, there was a shift in my heart that was palpable. And I immediately wanted to get down on my knees. And I fought it because I thought, this is crazy. You know, I don't believe in this. I don't know why I'm wanting to do this. And it took a few years. It took a few years of, the way I like to visualize it is my higher power and I were sitting on two opposite sides of the couch, and every now and then we'd move a little bit closer to each other, you know, and move a little bit closer. When I would see that he wasn't going to bite me, I'd move a little bit closer. And I think when he would see that I wasn't going to run away anymore, he would move a little bit closer. And, I have a beautiful relationship with a higher power today. But when my dad passed away, I didn't know what to do with that. I mean, I knew what to do, but I didn't know how to process the feelings. You know, this is the first major thing. I mean, I had been through breakups and whatever, but this was the first major thing that hit me when I was sober. And I dumped myself into service. I was the I was the administrative director of the Meditation Center in Columbia. I was the chair of the South Carolina convention, the AA convention, the state convention. I was sponsoring ladies. I was starting a home group with some other friends of mine. I was going into the prisons and carrying meetings. And I could not run. I could not run fast enough. I ran for a while, but in about 6 months' time, man, I hit a brick wall and everything fell apart. I didn't pick up a drink, but I definitely, like, I fell apart emotionally. And I didn't realize until recently how bad that really affected me. I moved to Atlanta at the beginning of 2019. And when I moved here, I started doing a lot of service at the meditation center here where I live. And this is why I live here, because this is where I moved. I moved here to Atlanta to live in a meditation center here in Atlanta. And did not get connected with Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta. And I would make, like, you know, I was making one meeting a week. And eventually, after the pandemic hit, that dropped to once every 2 weeks, once a month. You know, I didn't really understand that all the meetings had gone onto Zoom, you know, that they'd gone online. I didn't know that. So I was kind of lost. And I went back to a relationship that was completely inappropriate and spent 3 months over the summer barely going to meetings, and spending a lot of time with somebody who was drinking and who was doing a lot of dry goods. And I did not pick up. And that is, and I mean, they were within arm's reach of me. And I did not pick up. And I can say, I mean, the only reason I know that I did not pick up is because my higher power was protecting me. Just like he's protected me my entire life. My entire life. I left that relationship because, you know, he wasn't changing. I mean, you know, his alcoholism and his drug use were not the only things wrong with him. And, you know, I always have to check and say, well, what's wrong with me that I was attracted to that? Right? That's my side of it. Why am I attracted to this? Why do I want this in my life? And, I'm working through that with sponsors. But suffice it to say that by the beginning of October, I really hit an emotional bottom. And an example is that I called, you know, I had started coming back to meetings. And within the first week of coming back to meetings, I called one of my friends in South Carolina. So Amanda on here, and then I have another friend in South Carolina who were my anchors. They were my mainstays. And, you know, this friend told me, I called her and I was crying and I said, I can't remember my story. And, boy, I was not expecting that to hit me. That's a terrifying thing as an alcoholic. If you can't remember your story, you don't remember what it was like. You don't remember what happened. I mean, I've got chills coming up my spine right now at the thought of this, because that's, I mean, I don't regret the past, you know, and I'm not shutting a door on it, but, like, my story is how I remember that I don't want to go back there. What happened is how I remember why I don't want to go back there, and these are also, like, the only thing that I have to give a newcomer when they show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the only thing I have to give them to let them know that this will work, that they're not alone. For ladies, you know, that any of the things that they come to me crying, I did this, I did that, I did them too. I did those same things, and this is how I have resolved it in my life. And I was terrified. And she told me, she said, you just keep going to meetings, and your story will come back to you. And it has been coming back in pieces. I think that there are still things that I don't remember everything about yet, but I have been attending meetings fervently, like only the dying can, because it really it really terrifies me to think how close I was to picking up a drink last summer. And I know without a shadow of a doubt that that wasn't Heather not picking up that drink or that whatever, you know? So yeah, I don't know. I hope y'all got something out of that. I have been, one of the things, so I love to read things out of our literature when I speak. And I want to read you, I don't have one favorite anything. I don't have one favorite color. I don't have one favorite sponsee. I don't have one favorite, you know, whatever. I know, don't look at me like that, Amanda. I don't have one favorite anything, you know. So this isn't my favorite, but it is probably in the top three. And it's out of step one in the 12 and 12. It's the very first line out of step one in the 12 and 12. And it's this simple question: who cares to admit complete defeat? You know, my parents were Marines. My sons are Marines. I've got a long history of military people in my life. And I was never, ever, the concept of defeat was not anywhere in anything that we talked about. We don't do defeat. We keep pushing. You keep pushing until you get it right. And I'm really glad that my onion keeps peeling and that I keep finding new ways that I get to admit defeat. I'm kind of done. I'm hoping this is everything, that the last thing that I'm going through now is like the last thing. But I have a sense that it's probably not. I think as long as I can keep growing, that's what the whole point is. So thank you very much, Tim, for asking me to share my story with y'all tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Okay, hi. I just saw Julie's hand up. Hi, I'm Anna Doris. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, Heather. I'm speechless. I love your capacity for truth seeking and getting yourself a new pair of glasses and uncovering, discovering. There's nothing stagnant about you, and I love being part of this fellowship with you, and you give me so much every day. You did a great job telling your story. You know, made me feel like I got to ratchet up my honesty a few things here. You see things and you admit them and talk about them, and that's powerful. Thank you.
Boris, I love you.
Hey, I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Julie.
Hey. Heather, oh my gosh. Wow, thank you so much for telling your story tonight, and I love you, and you have become such a good friend to me in this program, and one of the first people I've met outside of Zoom, and I'm so thankful for that. And so much in your story has really touched my heart. I think, you know, first and foremost, a lot of us in AA have other programs going on, or if we're not working them, we have other issues that maybe we need to address. And I just love your honesty about that. No human is perfect, and we're all here because we have an issue with alcohol and probably other issues as well that need to be worked. And so it's people like you that really help newcomers like me, you know, peel that onion away. And then one last thing you said that I haven't heard anybody share it in a meeting yet, but man, it's something I've been thinking about, is the boomerang. You know, the minute I start judging someone, man, woman, whatever, in the program, out of the program, it comes around back at me. The more sober I get, the quicker it's coming around to me, and I'm noticing it. So it's really interesting that you said that, and I want to side talk to you about that later. But anyway, I could go on and on about you and how great you are, but I'll let other people do that. Thanks for letting me share.
Hi, Heather. It's Mindy. My gosh, what a beautiful, beautiful story. It's I just love to hear you talk, and your experience, strength, and hope, it just hits me at the heart, and I could relate to so much that you had to say. And it's such an honor to know such a strong, courageous woman like you. And thanks for just the truthfulness that you bring forth, like, you know, to Quarantine Sober every day. And you were one of my first friends to meet outside of Zoom too. And I speak on behalf of my daughter too. We both just love you, and you have the best playfulness about you. And I'll just say, as a side note, Heather went down the slide with my daughter and went swinging, and just, it was just so much fun just to get out and just play. And it was really awesome to see that side of you. And I love all sides of you. And just thanks for being so strong. You're really a role model in so many ways. Love you.
Thank you, Mindy.
Yeah, Heather, once I hear somebody's story, there's kind of like a bond that gets built between me and that person, because you just learn more about them. And after all, storytelling is how this whole shebang got started in the first place. So, I'm very glad to have been here to hear you. Thank you.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets insane and the lessons fall apart, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of God. Keep me out of the shadow of God. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.